Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts. Hey, it's Marvin. Thanks for listening to Books and Boba and our discussion of our July 2021 book club pick, An Ocean of Minutes by Tia Lim. This is just a quick content warning that there is a brief discussion of a sexual assault scene from the book. So if that kind of discussion makes you uncomfortable, please check out the time code listed in the show notes and just skip ahead about a minute and a half and you should be in the clear. All right, now to the show.
You're listening to...
Whoa!
Potluck.
And you're listening to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yu.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And it is time. Time, huh? Eh? Get it? To talk about our July 2021 book club pick, An Ocean of Minutes by Tia Lim.
So, Marvin, how did you like this book since it's a change of pace from our last month's pick, Happy Endings, which was a very raunchy romance novel?
I did enjoy it. Thank you for picking a sci-fi story to dig our teeth into. It turned out to be a story that I wasn't expecting it to become, and I was actually really surprised. But, you know, I'm glad to have read it and excited to be discussing it with you.
Yeah, it really did subvert a lot of my expectations for, like, time travel stories. I've consumed a lot of time travel stories and movies in my life. So it was definitely different from what I'm used to.
Yeah. All right, so let's just get straight into it. Because it is hot, and to record this podcast, we both have to turn off our AC. So before we roast alive in the Southern California heat wave, let's talk about Ocean of Minutes. This is your standard spoiler warning. Our discussion will encompass all things in Ocean of Minutes, including plot spoilers and themes. So if you haven't read the book yet and don't want to be spoiled, you know, go read the book now and come back and listen to us after you've finished. And if you don't care, or if being spoiled is a bonus or a feature of this podcast for you, then please just keep listening.
I do have to say that this is one of those books where you should probably read it before listening to this episode. Like, I feel like your experience would be a little bit ruined if you knew the ending and a lot of the plot twists. So, you know, that's my advice.
Rira's recommendations. All right, so let's get started. Rira, can you read us into An Ocean of Minutes?
In this novel, America is in the grip of a deadly flu pandemic. When Frank catches the virus, his girlfriend Polly will do whatever it takes to save him, even if it means risking everything. When she finds out there's a company that has invented time travel, she agrees to a radical contract. If she signs up for a one-way trip into the future to work as a bonded laborer, the company will pay for the life-saving treatment Frank needs. Polly promises to meet Frank again in Galveston, Texas, where she will arrive in 12 years. But when Polly is rerouted an extra 5 years into the future, Frank is nowhere to be found. Alone in a transformed and divided America with no status and no money, Polly must navigate a new life and find a way to locate Frank, determine if he is alive, and if their love has endured. So I was pretty surprised that for a time travel novel, it was set in the past. Because usually when you travel into the future, it's like a time period that we haven't experienced in like real life. But the future in this book is 2002.
Yeah, it took me a while to wrap my head around the fact that this takes place in an alternate timeline. It's an AU. Of our timeline, where a mutated flu pandemic sweeps the nation/the world, and you know, nothing like current times, nothing like what's happening right now. The United States.
Yeah, that was a thing. I was like, this book came out in 2018. And, you know, when people were reading it, it was like, oh, this is what life would be like if a pandemic hit. You know, it's like an alternate. Yeah. But now that we are living through a pandemic and we have been living through one for the past like year and like whatever months, almost 2 years at this point, we're just like, yeah, like a lot of similarities and a lot of parallels.
I mean, this is what we've been seeing a long time from science fiction authors is this ability to semi-predict how specifically the United States government will react to a pandemic, which is insist nothing is wrong and until it's too late.
Yeah, because forgive me if I'm incorrect, the last like dystopia apocalyptic novel that we read was Severance by Ling Ma, and that book was also about capitalism and how like America would be really bad at dealing with the pandemic, but at the same time, capitalism will endure in some way.
Yeah, it was a really interesting, I guess, literary move for Tia to do that. But I guess it also gives her the chance to, like, because we've always talked about this in terms of, like, contemporary fiction, which is, like, having access to the internet and cell phones changes the game. And, like, setting it in the 80s and 90s, which is a time before widespread use of the internet, it creates a setting where communication is way harder than it would have been, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think that was like one of the reasons why Tia set this book like at the turn of like the 20th century. Because in the back of the paperback, there's a Q&A with her, and she said that like that was one of the main reasons why. If you think about it, if someone from the 80s time traveel to, I guess, like the 2020s, 2010s, they would just be so confused with our lives with smartphones and Wi-Fi.
It would be like we were all living like kings and queens, right? Because I remember in like the late 90s, I had a prized 386 computer where I was able to play games like X-Wing or whatever. But like that computer probably costs twice as much as your standard smartphone and is probably like the 10th of the power. I mean, that's just how much technology has grown over the last like 10 years even.
Yeah, I mean, like in terms of communication, I'm just thinking about long distance relationships during like our parents' era. And I'm like, yo, they had to like do it the old fashioned way with letters
cards.
And the phone card. Yeah. The phone card. Oh my God. I used the phone card when I had to like call my grandparents.
Yeah.
And yeah, you could only call like maybe like once a month because of the rates. But now we have like WhatsApp and Zoom, and it's just so much easier to contact everyone. And yeah, like it would be a totally different book, and the struggles would just not exist if this was taking place in like the mid 2000s, 2010s. So one thing that was really, I guess, curious to me was the fact that time travel was invented, but they couldn't go back in time to reach patient zero because there was like a limit on like how far they can go back.
Yeah. How much did you think that was real and how much do you think that was bullshit?
See, like the entire time I thought it was bullshit. Like I thought that the company that like made the time travel thing exist, maybe they couldn't go back to patient zero, but they probably could have impacted like how the pandemic would spread, but they chose not to in order to capitalize on it. Because we've seen this in real life where real corporations will exacerbate like climate change and environmentalism to benefit their own pockets. So,
I mean, I guess the examples that come to mind is Enron in, I think, that was 2001, 2002, where they purposely jacked up the price of, like, energy during, like, the big wildfires that were happening in California. And then I'm thinking, like, you know, pharmaceutical companies who have been accused of withholding, like, more advanced medications because the less effective ones haven't played out its lifespan of profit yet.
Yeah, yeah. So that's why I was like, it kind of sounds like bullshit, but, you know,
you're
they
just too cynical. You're like, you don't believe any corporation
that is,
says.
That is right? True. When I was reading this book, I realized the extent of my cynicism. I was like, this book is supposed to be, I mean, a lot of sad, depressing things happen to Polly. And of course, like a lot of real life parallels are in this book. But the entire time I was like, I don't know if this would happen, or I would say that's not like, why would you be so naive as to like do this when the benefit isn't, I don't know, worth it.
I mean, it could be that time travel paradox. What was it? The grandfather paradox, where in order for time travel to be invented, the pandemic had to have happened. Right.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's true, because time travel was invented in 1993. And they were able to go back as far as, what, like 1981, which is like the time period that Polly and Frank are from. Because like when they're dating, it's still like the late 70s. So yeah, we go from like 1978, 79 to like 1998.
Yeah. 1998. Where were you in 1998?
In 1998. Oh, God. Was I still in New Jersey? I think I may have still been in New Jersey and in middle school.
I was a freshman in high school. I had just entered high school.
Wait, never mind. Yeah. I would have been 8 years old, so I was definitely not in middle school. I have no recollection of like my middle school years, my elementary school years, except for the really, really traumatic stuff.
Oh, but no.
Yeah. But yeah, like,
so you're not one of those people who looks back on the good old days of high school and middle school?
No, because once the internet happened, that was when I started to have friends and realized that I was actually, I don't know, like worthwhile as a human being.
Oh, no. So,
yeah, I didn't, like not exactly remember back in the 90s, like. Yeah, like I'm not much of like a 90s aficionado when it comes to like, like.
So the current trend of like 90s nostalgia is doing nothing for you?
No, it absolutely not. The only nostalgia I have for the 90s is probably like anime related. But that's pretty much it. Like anime and Pokemon. And that's pretty much it. But nostalgia is a big theme in this book, especially since it's set in like the 80s and the 90s. I feel like those time periods are known for its nostalgia the most. I mean, turn on the radio and it's mostly like 80s rock band and 90s hip hop.
I mean, that's considered classic music now, right? For better or worse. I think we've passed 80s nostalgia and we've moved into 90s nostalgia and even early 2000s nostalgia. I've been seeing some trends from when I was in high school coming back, and I don't know whether to be happy or sad about it. Emo music, quote unquote, emo pop's coming back. Like, I've been seeing people, like youth around me, dressed like we did with like the baggy pants, with like, you know what else is coming back? Bucket hats. I've been seeing a lot more bucket hats.
Love bucket hats. Okay. Like, I used to wear them all the time, and I even wore them like in college. Love it.
I mean,
that's never going to go out of fashion. I'm sorry.
I mean, the late 90s was also like the, I guess it was the second wave of K-pop, which is like the SES days, the HOT days. Like,
that's the first wave. Yeah, that's the first wave, because K-pop became popularized with HOT and they came out in like 1995.
Oh, okay.
Yes. I know my fucking K-pop history. <All right.
laughs> Like, I assume there was a generation before them, but I guess not.
The second wave is around 2003. So that's with like TVXQ. And,
oh, that's like all the big girl groups and stuff, right? Like the giant, yeah, the giant groups. Like,
What year did Girls' Generation come out? I know that like K-pop like kind of blew up internationally, like outside of LA, in like 2009.
But
so
the
that's
generation
when, like, YouTube became like a big thing.
But the generation with like the bucket hats and like the oversized jerseys, that was the first.
Yeah, first gen. Okay. That was because like you have to think about like hip hop, because hip hop was all about like the bucket hat and like baggy clothes and like the shoes. I mean, shoes are still like a big deal in hip hop. Anyway, we're probably going to cut this part out.
No, we're staying in. This has been your K-pop education minute. You know what else is coming back? Vans and skater wear.
They've never gone away.
Really?
Yeah, I don't think they've ever gone away. Maybe they're becoming more popular now, but I feel like it's always been a part of, like, I don't know, like streetwear, and that's, yeah, I don't know. trends come and go, and kids, you'll realize that you should keep all of your clothes because trends come back and you don't want to spend extra money on.
I know.
Stuff that they're going to overprice.
My partner came to my place and did a cleansing of all the stuff that doesn't bring her joy. And so all the clothes that have come back around, I don't no longer have. Like, I don't have any of my baggy clothes. I don't have my baggy jeans, my visors, my bucket hats. All the stuff that she does not want me to wear anymore is gone.
There are clothes that I've definitely taken from, like, my mom's closet. And, you know, my mom got it from, like, my grandmother because she, like, made those clothes. So it's, yeah, like, things come back. But anyway. Yeah,
anyways.
Sorry. So what did you think about the bureaucracy of getting of time traveling? Because you see this in immigration and, like, yeah, refugee
migration. I actually want to talk about that. I was really surprised that this time travel story wasn't actually really about time travel. I mean, time travel is the setting, and it's like the mechanism by which this story functions. But the story is really about, like, a refugee immigrant experience, right? Like, Polly is essentially a time migrant worker, right? Like, she travels through time specifically to work in order to pay off the cost of, like, a loan that she takes out to A, save Frank's life, and B, pay for the time travel. And she has to pay for, like, her lodging and pay for her meals and her, like, expenses, which is something that, like, it's basically indentured servitude, and it's something that, like, a lot of, like, I don't know if it happens in the States as much. It probably does, but definitely in, like,
does.
Asia, in, like, factory towns where, like, you have people coming from the countryside to work at a factory who live in company dorms and, like, live in company towns. Like, it's something that happens to them too. Like, they have a company credit, they get kind of sucked in, and they kind of have to live there to pay off their debts. Right. In order to
and
survive.
The thing is, they keep adding expenses, so you don't actually get the chance to leave when you want to.
Yeah, which is, like, the oldest, like, it's basically how these types of companies have functioned since the Industrial Revolution, right? And so reading the book reminded me of, there's a song by Chinese American artist Vienna Tang called No Gringo.
I think it was part of her
third album, which is about, like, a hypothetical future where the border with Mexico has inversed. And basically, people from America would sneak into Mexico for jobs and economic stability. And it's kind of, it reminded me of that, where it's like time travel becomes a new border and the delineation is no longer, well, it's still white and brown, white and black, but also, like, past and future, right? Like, people who don't belong here, people who come here just to work, how they're treated as second-class citizens. And it was interesting how, like, Polly, who is, like, a white-passing Middle Eastern woman, right? Like, Lebanese is...
Yeah, she's mixed race. So she's part Lebanese and part white.
Which Lebanese still counts as Caucasian, right?
Yeah, like, actually Caucasian. Because you know how people say, like, oh, I'm Caucasian, but it's, like, the origin of Caucasian is you live in the Caucasus area in between Asia and Europe. And it's anyway, that's a different thing.
But it's used as code as white. And, like, Polly also uses it as, like, I guess it means I'm white, like Caucasian, right? She says Caucasian instead of white because...
I mean, isn't that what's, like, on government forms, though?
I think,
like,
so.
Caucasian.
I don't know. I just feel Asian.
White.
So, you know, I don't look at any of the boxes.
But I thought it was interesting because when she goes in and they're like, okay, your race is what? And she says Caucasian, and the interviewer kind of gives her a strange look and says, Caucasian and what? And I was like, whoa, man, like, that is incredibly, incredibly rude.
But it's, I mean, I don't know how many times you've gone through international customs. They're all rude. They're all like that. I got harassed by a border agent once for being Canadian. and having a green card. And he was saying,
wait, are you kidding me?
Yeah, he was like, you know, we can take this away anytime, right?
No, you can't. No, I've never had that experience before.
Just me. Then.
But it's interesting because she gets an O-1 visa, which is like the specialized skill visa. And then everyone else has like the N-1 visa, which is, you know, just like the regular visa. And you have like a longer period of time that you have to work as an indentured servant. And we noticed that like the O-1 visa holders are pretty much all white. Like they're all white ladies.
Yeah. And okay, so it was endlessly amusing, or not, maybe not amusing, maybe a little depressing, that you have this great technology for time travel, and there are so many applications you can use it for, but what do the corporations of the future use it for? To bring in cheap labor for their resorts.
Yeah, when Polly said that she was an upholsterer who repairs old furniture, I was like, what are you going to do with that skill in the future? You know, like I thought they would hire like more doctors or
you
people
would
who work
think
in,
so right because yeah. Like, the entire idea of this time travel like shifting is like, okay, in the future population's been decimated, we don't have enough skilled workers, so we need to bring people from the past before they get killed by the virus to, you know, take up these posts. Or that's how I would think, but no, it's like, all right, there's not enough people to work at our resorts and to like make this into like a tourist destination. We need to bring in cheap labor from the past before they all die. Because like we've seen in this pandemic, the people most hardly hit by pandemics are the poor, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And let's bring them in so we can have more labor to serve our rich clients.
Yeah. And if you think about like in the first chapter, before Frank gets sick and they're seeing the advertisements for Time Razor, he says they don't advertise this to the rich. And it's totally true because the rich can afford the really expensive health insurance, healthcare to, you know, recover from the flu. Whereas everybody else, they need to like be indentured servants
right,
to even have access to it.
There is a cure by now. The cure came back from the future, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like, I'm not sure if it was like a full on cure or if it was.
It was treatment, at least. It was.
Yeah, it was. Treatment it was.
They were able to save Frank, who was like, you know, almost dead when Polly left.
Yeah, and like 6 months later, he's fine. So.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We'll talk about Frank later because that's we gotta unpack that whole like the romance angle of this time travel romance, or romance with a question mark.
But I thought it was really interesting on how, like, time travel, there is so much bureaucracy, right? Like, they don't tell the people who are applying to stuff, like, all of the small print things that are, like, hidden in like, the terms and conditions.
I mean,
and when everybody gets to, like, the I guess, like, terminals, like, no one knows where they're going. No one knows what they're doing. And they're just giving out false information. And it's like, yeah, that is pretty much... Like,
that's like
everything.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's pretty much like corporations 101, right? Like, do any of us read the end user license agreements anytime we sign up for anything online? Probably not. Do we read everything in our mortgage? Do we read everything in like the employment contracts that we sign? Probably not, right? And they're counting on that. And that way they can say, well, you signed this, so we can do this. And
but do you have a choice, though? Because, like, Polly goes to save Frank's life, and she's going to do it no matter what. It's just...
I mean, isn't that just, like, institutions taking advantage of the poor and vulnerable? Like,
oh,
this is kind of, like... I mean, all time travel stories or all science fiction stories are allegories, right? They're meant to shine a light on our lives to make us think about how... You know, what are the things we're doing now that will lead to this hypothetical future? And like nothing that Time Razor is doing is anything new. It's stuff that's been going on since the beginning of like essentially corporations, right? The beginning of you know, capitalism as like the main form of business and economy in the world. And yeah, Polly's story is kind of her dealing with that, like dealing with the ways that corporate entities and institutions take advantage of people who are desperate.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing is, because she is like O-1 visa, and because she can pass as white and pass as like someone who is of higher status, like she, I thought the code switching was really interesting, you know, like she thinks at the very beginning that if she's polite, like, and kind of like asserts herself, that she'll get what she wants, kind of like, oh, if I pretend to be a Karen, they'll give me like all of the answers that I'm looking for. But then once she kind of, you know, falls from grace, she has to like be, you know, she has to be silent, keep her head down. That is the only way to survive. This is like totally, totally random. But the whole like when she's going through like the psychological exam or whatever in order to like pass the O-1 visa, and like how they tell her that she's going to 1993, but she's actually being rerouted to 98 because that's the time period that her employer needs her. And they never inform her because it was just like an administrative error. And it just reminded me of when I went to go get my citizenship test. Like, you know, it's a really big building. And the security guard was like, oh, go to like the fourth floor. So I went. And I'm like waiting and waiting, and they're still like not calling my number. And I was like, well, it's like the government. Everything is slow. So I guess, you know, like if they're like an hour long wait, it's fine. So I wait like an hour and a half, and I was just like, what the fuck is this? So I go up to like one of the staff, and I'm like, hey, I'm here for my citizenship test, and the security guard told me to come up here. And they're like, oh, no, you're in the wrong floor. It's like the second floor. And then I go to the second floor, and like the people there are like, oh, like you missed your appointment, so you have to like reschedule it. And you know, with citizenship tests, like it's like months of like rescheduling. So I said, fuck no, I am staying here until, you know, like someone doesn't show up or whatever. And that's what happened. But
that's pretty bold.
But anyway, like it was just like a lot of bullshit where it totally was not my fault, but the government was saying, no, it's your responsibility to like know where you're supposed to go, and it's your fault for like not paying attention. And it's like, but you gave me the wrong information. So like,
yeah,
like, what the hell?
And that's kind of how time racer is, right? Everyone has their own specific thing they're doing, and they don't care about anyone else. So if someone else messes up, it's at least it's not their fault. And that's kind of, you know, as someone who was like in a past career or life has worked not in government but with government, I want to say a lot of people working in government are like that, where it's just like, I just care about my little domain, and anything outside of it is not my fucking problem, right? And it's, I mean, it goes back to just the journeymen, right? The people who travel to the future to work aren't seen as people. They're seen as like company property and resources who have no rights, right? Everything they do is a cost to the company. And so that cost is, instead of being subsidized by the company to like give them a better experience, they're rediverted back to their workers, like inundating them with even more debt. And I mean, I don't know if they can unionize, but they should really probably start a union at some point, right?
Like, what I found really interesting was, like, Polly gets to the future, and everyone kind of expects her to know, like, the history of what happened after the pandemic. And, like, she finds out that America and the United States had, like, two separate countries.
America
now
has broken up with the United States, which, okay, it's a little cheesy, but also really hilarious that's how they decided to split the country, which is this side is America and this side are the United States.
I mean, if you think about it, with like the Civil War, like, wasn't that what they were aiming for? The South wanting?
I mean, even then, though, at least they had different names. It wasn't just the United States literally cut in half.
Yeah. Yeah. it was very interesting and funny to me because they just expected her to know that it was like two separate countries and that she wasn't a citizen because she wasn't here when America was founded. And therefore, she's on a visa, even though she was sent by the company to work there. And, you know, she's kind of treated as someone who's pretty much stupid because, you know, she doesn't know all the things that she should know. She's taking the wrong bus. And it turns out that, like, you know, the bus driver was wrong, like, in terms of, like, picking her up. And it was just like, oh, it's not my fault. Like, it's your fault for, like, getting on the wrong bus. And, yeah, it was just, like, a lot of blaming.
Yeah, I mean, this story at its core is about Polly's refugee experience, right? It reminded me a lot of The Map of Salt and Stars, which we read about a year ago, I want to say, which was about a Syrian child's journey, like, as escaping her war-torn country. Like, given this story isn't as bleak, they're still escaping, like, certain doom. But it's about, like, basically her becoming a second-class citizen, having to figure out how to survive. And I think it was a really smart move for Tia Lim to cast her main character as, like, a white woman who has to, like, kind of become the second-class citizen because of a status that, like, she had no choice but to accept, right? Because I feel like, for better or worse, having a white character makes it more, like, it feels icky to say this, but, like, probably more relatable to a lot of mainstream readers who can, you know, relate to her better, I guess. And that way the message of, like, you know, here is what an immigrant refugee goes through in order to even, like, you know, find a new life in a place where, like, because of arbitrary decisions on, like, who isn't a citizen and borders and things like that, like, she has to go through all this bullshit, right, where people don't even treat her as a human being.
Yeah, and it also, like, reminds me of, like, a lot of immigrants in this country where in their former countries and in, like, the motherland, they had, like, really well-paying or respectful jobs. And by circumstance, they came to America and all of that status and prestige from their original country is just lost. Like, no one gives a fuck.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you were a doctor in your former country. Well, you have to go through med school again in America. So you can, like, treat patients in English or whatnot. And it's just, yeah, it just kind of reminded me of that. Because even though Polly is, you know, in a field where, you know, they specifically recruited her for this job to repair furniture, like, she's still treated as, like, terrible. But at the same time, like, she understands that it could be a lot worse because, like, when she looks outside the window, she sees, like, where all of the N1 workers are, like, you know, they're showering outside. There's no privacy. They're living in shipment containers. And she's like, yeah. Well, at least I'm not them.
So yeah. And I mean, they're doing the jobs that no one else wants to do, which is, like, little on the nose allegory for, like, migrant workers here, right? Like, they're the people doing the jobs that quote unquote regular Americans don't want to do, even though they're still mad at them for taking jobs. And so, like, I want to talk about the question of, like, why people do this, right? Like, why go through all this? Like, because Polly's reason is not for herself. Like, a lot of people did this to survive, to get jobs. They traveled with their families. It was a way for them to live through the pandemic. But Polly did it to save Frank. I mean, you can argue whether or not it was a selfish reason. It was definitely an impulsive reason. And it was for someone else, right? And Frank kind of, like, reuniting with Frank, who at this point she still believes to be the love of her life, becomes her driving force for, like, the first 8/10 of the novel.
Yeah. I had a lot of feelings about Polly and Frank's relationship. Because, like, first off, like, they're boyfriend and girlfriend. They're, like, as serious as they are, they're not married and she's not, like, a family relative. So I just found that, like, I'm just like, you're 23 and you're going to sign into indentured servitude for a relationship that, you know, might not have been as stable as you thought you thought it might be. Like, you see it with, like, the other indentured journeyman. They're like, oh, it's nice that, you know, you did this for your boyfriend. You did this out of love and you believe that you'll be reunited again. But that's something that happens in fairy tales. That's not something that like actually happens. And I seem to kind of like line myself up with that opinion. I was just like, why are you doing this? But at the same time, I'm like, I haven't been in that position of given the option to save a loved one. And it's like,
yeah.
Yeah.
And it kind of becomes her. I mean, it drives her throughout the story. It also gets her in a shitload of trouble. I mean, her trying
she
to find
not
Frank.
Thinking for. Yeah.
Yeah.
She made some real bad decisions.
But I think. Yeah, I can understand why she did it, even though I don't agree with what she did. But that's us having the benefit of knowledge of having read their relationship through like an omniscient third person narrative. Because I mean, even in the flashbacks, like where they were at the time when Frank contracted the illness was not a very like stable time in their relationship, right? It was kind of like they were kind of on shaking ground. They were maybe starting to reconcile, and maybe that led to her decision. Like, okay, like we were just starting to like make up for this disastrous DC trip. Like, I don't want to lose this now. And it ends up losing way more than she thought she would. But like Frank during that DC trip was kind of a dick.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I think it's just like a difference of values, because Polly the entire time, she's like, well, like we'll have like all of these holiday trips in the future. Like, why do we have to like go do all of these touristy things in DC? Like, why can't we just stay in the hotel and just be, I don't know, just like be lazy bums?
Yeah,
and
a vacation should be a vacation, right? So
yeah, but they have different definitions of how they want to spend their time and what's considered to be quote unquote like romantic or couple activities. And that was like the first sign to me where, well, not the first sign, because like at the very beginning when I was reading this book, I was like, yeah, Frank is not like, I don't know about this decision to go save someone who, you know, is your boyfriend and you're, I mean, there are married couples out there who.
Well, you're a practical, logical person. So, you know, obviously you would probably spend more time weighing the pros and cons of doing this.
I mean, this is really funny because I am a very cynical person when it comes to like romantic relationships, but like I've been in a relationship that's been like, it's been 10 years since I've been with my partner. I've been with Dan since I was 21. And like, you know, like it was like what, like 6 months into our relationship where I said, hey, I'm gonna move to the other side of the country after I graduate. So that's what I'm gonna do. And I was totally expecting the whole like breakup thing, because I was like, in my opinion, like long distance is, it's just not something that I was willing to put myself through. But like literally as soon as I said I'm moving to LA, he was like, okay, like when do we want to move? And I was like, you're planning to come with me? And he was like, yeah, like I want to be with you. So yeah, like when do you want to do this? And that's something that does not happen. And
so you're saying in your relationship, your partner is the Polly.
I mean, I think we're both very considerate with our values and just compromising and stuff. But like it is very rare. And, you know, for someone who is in that type of relationship, I had my cynicism, so I could not help but be cynical about like Polly and Frank's relationship.
But she is like, she is still young. Their relationship is like maybe at this point 2 years old, right? Which is still relatively early. I guess in the 80s, it might have been a long time. I don't know. 80s values I don't align with because I don't know them. Especially 80s in like the upstate New York culture. I mean, you mentioned the difference in the way that they perceive like, or they value like the present and the future. And those are things I think they might have been able to work out given more time together. But this thing happens, the pandemic, which rips them apart.
It did pose the question of, like, how much are you responsible for someone else's life? And, like, how much self-sacrifice is too much sacrifice?
Yeah.
Is that right to do? Is it selfish in a way to sacrifice that much for someone you love without considering their wishes? Because Frank tells her not to go.
Yeah. And, like, I kind of want to talk about, like, I think we should talk about when she does eventually make it back to Buffalo, right? This is after she, like, gets literally, like, conned twice, I want to say. Not conned, but, like, you know, she gets set up by her boss to take a fall for his mistakes, which is, you know, something bosses. Yeah, which yeah. is, you know, which is really messed up. I mean, do you have any thoughts on Baird and his, like, bullshit?
I think Baird was an interesting character because he represented what could have happened to Polly, because he had the option of being a journeyman, but he didn't decide to do that. So he watched his partner die. Whereas, like, with Polly, you know, she chose to be this indentured servant and she's going through all this hardship, but there is a possibility that she can reunite with her love and be able to pick the pieces back up. So the reader is kind of questioning, like, who is suffering more in this case? Like, is it better to be with your loved one and kind of spend the time that you have together? Or is it better to, you know, make these sacrifices in hope for a future that is not guaranteed? I don't know. Like, for personally, I would not do the whole journeyman thing. I would probably stay behind and be like Bard or whatever his character's name is.
I mean,
like, yeah.
I mean, this might just be the perspective, like, maybe because male and females are separated, but most of the characters we find in this, like, indentured servitude status are women, and especially women of color, right?
Like, we have to think about it in like terms of, are women expected to sacrifice more than men? And I would have to say yes. Like, because, like, if you look at, like, the 1980s, for example, like, sure, there was a lot of progress in, like, feminism. Like, you're seeing, like, women get more jobs and, of course, like, fight for, like, autonomy in terms of, like, having rights to birth control and also, like, being able to divorce and still being able to retain some kind of property or whatever. A lot of things were in the works, and yet it was not common. It was still expected for women of that time to just give up everything for their family. And it makes sense to me that a lot of the people who did become journeymen were women, and they did it to save their husbands and their sons and whatnot.
Yeah. And some part of me, I mean, I'm sure a lot of readers felt this, was like, did Frank take advantage of that kindness, which he totally did, right? I mean, we can skip ahead to, well, okay, do we want to skip past the part where, do you have any thoughts on when Baird, like, stabbed Polly in the back?
I kind of expected it, like, from, like, the fact that he was drunk most of the time and didn't do any work. I was just like, yeah, it's gonna bite her in the ass, because he asked her to steal something for him. And, like, I was just like, don't do it. Like, what are you doing?
Well, he,
like,
used Frank as, like, her weakness, right? He used Frank to get her to steal stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But she should have thought it through. But at the same time, you're put in a very desperate situation that most people would not imagine themselves in. So it's hard to say, like, how you would react. But it was just like, yeah, he's gonna backstab her. And of course, because she was an O1 status, it made sense to me that, like, for this story to progress, she would have to be demoted and kind of endure the hardship that a lot of women of color face in this book. So I kind of expected the trajectory of her path pretty predictable, but, like, not in, like, a bad way, because it was believable.
Yeah. And there's an interesting thing when she becomes a N1 worker where all of a sudden her whiteness is pretty much taken away from her.
What was the thing that Cookie said to her? Like, oh, you were white until you were broke.
Yeah. Something like that. Cookie was a great character. I like Cookie a lot.
Yeah, she reminded me a lot of like older Asian aunties.
Yeah, she was like all of my Vietnamese friends' mom. That's Cookie. Like, yeah, I mean, when people saw her afterwards, they all assumed like she was Hispanic, right? They would talk to her in Spanish, even though she, you know, identified as Caucasian.
Yeah, and also like because like Tia Lim is also mixed race, so I would imagine that was drawn from her own personal experiences of like never being white enough or Asian enough, yeah. Depending on like where she is. Cause I'm sure that like in Canada, which is where she went to school, actually she went to school in Houston and I think she lives in Toronto now.
Okay.
But I'm guessing that like she gets questions all the time being like, oh, like what kind of Asian are you? Like you don't look white. You must be something else.
Yeah.
But then when she goes to Asia, when she goes to Singapore, which is where she grew up, I'm sure she probably gets the same question, but it's like in inverse.
Yeah.
So it really depends on like the environment that you're in and when you're not like.
And who people believe belong.
Yeah.
There,
and who people
right?
believe. Yeah. The whole thing with Noberto.
Yeah.
And like there's a part where. So he, you know, proposes a scheme to her and she's like, well, how do you know about this scheme? And he's like, oh, well, there's a fixer and he's going to get a percentage.
Oh,
I was just like,
he was definitely getting scammed.
I was just like, what are you doing, man? Like, think things through. And
you're supposed
to
be the smart, like street savvy one.
And of course, you know, he gets swindled of all of his money. And the whole deal with the fixer is. They were going to provide him with like the pregnant urine sample because the whole point of the scheme is to say, hey, we're a couple that are that's expecting. So give us like the extra income, the extra extra goods to start a family. And now that they don't have the evidence to apply for this special treatment, he's like, oh, I'm going to try and like rape you so that you get pregnant. And it's only going to be for like 1 or 2 years and then you can like do whatever you want. And it just made me think about the women who didn't have a Noberto, like they were like probably like kidnapped and raped solely for the purpose of like.
Yeah,
their rape is getting ahead, and it was just like a very like uncomfortable feeling.
That was a
that
really
part with the sexual assault.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind like you don't expect it because he seems like a good dude, but at the same time, like, he's not someone that comes from privilege, right? He's the privilege of being a dude, but he's still someone who is under the thumb of the company and under the thumb of debt. And I mean, the part where he attempts to rape her was really uncomfortable to read. What did you think about his like turnaround? Did you expect him to come back around and like kind of
no,
redeem himself?
No, I totally did not. I did not expect him to pay off her debt and like get her a ticket to Buffalo. That was like totally unprecedented in my opinion.
Do you think it's out of character? I feel like he did seem like at least a guy who wants to be a good dude.
Yeah, because if you think about his backstory, when he was like in love with his girlfriend Marta, like he was pretty happy living in the wilderness and like not caring about, you know, making money or you know, being somewhat important in society. But his girlfriend left him because she couldn't stand like being poor and that kind of drove his decision to make money, try to be autonomous, be the boss. And I think after losing pretty much everything he saved in like the past decade and him doing something that he thought he would never do, like it makes sense to me that like he would try to redeem himself. I just didn't think that he would redeem himself like to that extent.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
But that leads Polly to return to Buffalo in the new United States, which... Again, she's no longer a citizen of because And I think this was something that was really amusing to me, was the fact that like the United States government dissolved and reformed as two countries, which I feel like our current government is on the brink of every single day over the last like 4 years.
I know, right?
But yeah, like she returns to Buffalo and sees that everything has changed. And she finally finds Frank and his daughter. I guess I want to say I was not surprised that Frank kind of moved on without her. I mean, I feel like the whole entire book was kind of leading up to this moment, right? Where like the sole reason for her to survive and to like get out of indentured servitude, it would turn out to be that nothing was there for her at the end.
Yeah, I kind of figured from like the photograph that he sneaked into her bra, like in the very first chapter when she's going to the time machine, because it just felt like, because she thinks that he's giving it to her to say like, hey, like, don't forget about me. Like, you know, like we're going to be together again. This is a memento. But to me, it was like a goodbye present. And I was like, oh, yeah, he's totally not going to wait. Like, because, you know, this sounds like an action that someone would do knowing that they're never going to see their loved one again, whether it's through death or through other circumstances.
I mean, I feel like it's in character. Like we mentioned, like Frank is someone who cares about like experiencing everything now. And I think Frank was probably thinking either if he dies or he never sees her again, he wants her to remember them as they were. Whereas she was always like, no, we're going to be together again. Why are you doing this? Then she ends up burning that picture, right? Or getting rid of it.
I mean, she couldn't have brought it anyway, because all paper stuff gets destroyed in the time travel.
Yeah, but she brought her baseball cards.
Yeah, but that was like laminated or something. like I don't know, but she does tear up the photograph, and
yeah,
you know, she thinks that she doesn't need it and she regrets it later on. But I was surprised by how quickly he moved on. And I think Polly was also very surprised and also horrified.
I mean, so was Donna. Donna was like, what the fuck, dude?
Donna was great. Donna was probably my favorite character in this book.
She was like, you come back without my niece, and now you have a kid with this other woman?
It ain't right.
No.
It ain't right. The fact that, like that he met his ex-wife at the hospital where he was recovering and then got married to her, like, what, 2 years after Polly disappeared? Like, it was very, very quick.
I think it was months, right? Was it?
Like, he recovered after 6 months.
I mean, they got married because he knocked her up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, like, you know, he was saying, like, oh, I needed comfort. I needed someone to, like, you know, I just needed somebody to, like, warm my body or whatever. And it's just, like, that's such a typical excuse.
That's like a lot of guys give. I mean, yeah, that's totally something an F-boy would say.
That's something that, like, every, you know how, like, in college, there's always that one person who has, like, a significant other who's, like, still in high school or whatever. And it's just, like... and like they tell
where I thought this anecdote was gonna go. I thought you were talking about like the person who was like always in the relationship.
No, I was talking about like, so okay, so like maybe I phrased this wrong, but like there's always someone in college who has like a significant other, whether or not like they're in high school or they went to a different college. Okay, that's a little bit better. And there's always one who thinks that they're gonna like make it despite the distance. Whereas, like, everybody else around them are just like,
we're talking about
in college.
What did you guys call it? Because we called it the turkey drop, like Thanksgiving turkey drop.
I don't know. I was not friends with those people. Like, which I guess just says something about me. I'm a no-nonsense person.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I did have a roommate, though, who, like, it was, like, sophomore year of college. She was engaged. And her fiancé was, like, you know, not in college. He was like older.
Oh, wow.
I think he was like 25 or whatever. And like at this time we were like 19, 20. And like, you know, I would just be like, hey, yeah, like, you know, good for you. And inside I'm just like, this is not gonna this is not going to work. And if it does work, like, I commend the guy. Like, this just seems like a doomed relationship. And that's kind of how I felt about, like, Polly and Frank. I'm like, it's like, oh, sweetie, like, did you really think that this was going to work out?
Just, yeah. I mean, the root of Polly's relationship with Frank is he's probably her first, like, serious boyfriend, right?
I mean, it sounded like her first boyfriend was serious, but in a way where he was like a total, like, bastard who,
yeah,
you know, was probably abusive. And she just, you know, like, Frank was like the first good guy that she dated.
I mean, he got her furniture back for her, right? That was like the catalyst for their relationship.
And, you know, I think I agree with you to a certain extent that if the pandemic hadn't happened, if they had more time together, they may have, like, worked out. And this is just my general thoughts on relationships. If you don't grow together, you're not going to survive together. And a lot of the times, like, you know, long distance wise, like, it doesn't work out because, you know, one person doesn't put in as much effort as the other person. And it happens to couples, you know, who have been living together for a very long time, but, you know, they change as a person. You can't expect someone to stay the same after 12, 15 years, which was like a thing that like Polly kind of realizes. You know, for her, it's only been a couple of months since she took this contract as an indentured servant. But for Frank, it's been like over a decade. And when they do try to, like, sleep together, she's unable to do it because he is just so different from the Frank that she remembers.
Yeah. What did you think about future Frank?
Oh, future Frank. I will say that future Frank is more along the... If she met Frank now, like, if she met the future Frank instead of, like, her present day Frank, I think future Frank would have been a better choice as a partner. I don't know. He just seems to have, like, more of a shit together and, you know, is more...
I mean, he is 13 years older, right?
So, he is 13 years older.
I mean, we forget that when they were dating, at least she was 20, like 23. Like, I want to say he was still in his late 20s, maybe. Like, I know he was definitely older than her.
Was definitely older than her.
And, like, as recent 20-somethings, we both know that 20-somethings are kind of dumb sometimes.
I don't know. I think I was pretty smart as a 20-something. But you know what? Like, I'm an old cynical person. Like, I've always been an old cynical person ever since I was like 10 years old.
You're an old soul.
Really, I'm an old soul. But I think with Frank, the future day Frank is definitely less selfish. And
he has more regrets, like way more regrets.
More regrets. I think he appreciates, like, he understands sacrifice more than present day Frank.
But
was
also kind of a coward, right? He did.
Oh, of course, like 100% a coward. Like, who the fuck gets married like 2 years after?
Well, and then
your
when
ex does this thing for you,
your ex,
life changing, life saving thing for you, like,
yeah. And then technically, you never broke up with her, right? So, and then when the girl comes back to, like, find you as you both promised, you send your daughter to go shoo her away. That was fucked
up. That was fucked up. Yeah, that was very, I mean, it was understandable, but at the same time, my sympathy for him was just not, it was just not there.
What did you think about them parting on amicable? I'm glad they were able to at least reconcile, even though, like, things were ever going to be the same.
I know, I'm pretty sure there were a lot of readers out there who were pissed by the ending, because I'm sure they expected, like, more of a resolution. And it just kind of left a lot of questions, because it's like, what is Polly going to do now? Like, is she going to have, like, a career? I mean, she's working at this dilapidated library that's going to be razed to the ground at some point.
I was more upset at the fact that I feel like Frank owes her a lot.
Yeah, he owes her so
and
much.
it seems like he's trying to weasel out of it, right? Like, much like a lot of the people who are from the future in this story, like, trying to shirk their responsibilities because they can, because Polly is someone who will forgive them, because Polly, at her core, is a maybe still a naive, like, innocent person, even though she's been hardened by all these experiences.
I think, like, she does what she needs to do, whereas with Frank, he is not that kind of person. I mean, you see it, like, in, like, was it their first date with the squirrel? How, like, the squirrel got run over and he was like, oh, we should end the squirrel's, like, misery because it's gonna die. Like, it's better to just, like, kill it now. And she's like, okay. But he's unable to do it, so she does it. And he's just like, wow, like I admire you because you're able to, like, do the things that needs to be done, or like, you're fair. And it's just like, dude, like, you suggested that, like, that you do this and you didn't even follow through. And same thing with, like, her, like, him encouraging her to apply to that, like, furniture repair program at a college. And, you know, she says, like, oh, like, I'm not going to do it. But she applies and she gets in, and then he's, like, disappointed. And, you know, like, he makes the effort to drive 6 hours to see her. But at the same time, he's, like, complaining about the distance. So the entire time, I'm just like, this guy.
It was red, like, flag after red flag, right?
It was red flag after red flag. So it did not surprise me that, you know, he didn't follow through on his promise, and that, like, in the future when they do get reunited, he doesn't do nearly enough redeem himself.
I mean, we all have that friend, right, who, like, we have no idea why they're with their significant other. There are all these glaring red flags that all of us can see, but, like, they obviously can't, and we can't figure out why. And I feel like Polly was that friend for all the readers.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, I was fine with the ending. Long story short, I was fine with the ending. I think it fits very well with the time travel theme. I don't know if you noticed, but the future chapters where she's, like, in America, it was written in past tense. But then with the flashbacks with Frank, it was written in present tense.
Oh.
So, to me, it was, like, a very interesting juxtaposition, because it's like she's constantly living in this time period where, like, everything about her relationship was rosy. But us as readers were like, no, it was red flag after red flag. Like, this is not a relationship that's going to work out. And finally, when she is able to kind of accept the reality of the situation, like, I think all of the other thoughts about Frank is in past tense from there. There was, like, that one short chapter where it was written in first person. It kind of threw me off because I was like, who's talking right now? For a second, I thought it was Frank, but it was actually Polly. And it made me curious as to how different this book would have been if it was written purely from her perspective, because I feel like it would have been interesting to get more into her head of, like, I'm in love and this is, like, this is gonna happen. Like, I feel like it would have been more powerful in terms of, like,
would it be more powerful or more frustrating? Because, like, I don't know if I want to see
thing. It would be more frustrating. It would be more frustrating, and it would have made the betrayal, like, it would have made it hurt more. But I understand the whole omnipotent, like, narrator style, because it's, you know, it's a time travel story.
In other words, I feel like Rira wanted more hurt. She wanted more pain from this book than it offered.
More pain would have been good.
I mean, the entire book was, like, coated in, like, melancholic ennui, like, you know, where, I mean, and it's something that we kind of can relate to now that we've also been through, they're still experiencing our own, you know, pandemic, given it's not as bad as the one in the book yet. But this idea that the world will never be back to how it was, right?
Yeah. Nina from our Goodreads forum, she raised some good points. I'm just going to read them. Lim manages to not only describe in detail Polly's experience navigating life after time travel, but also makes the reader feel the constant tension of things never going the way we intend, how relentlessly little control Polly has over her life the moment she decides to use it to save Frank, and the realization of things never being the way they once were.
Yeah.
The melancholy of knowing things will never be as they were is a constant background to An Ocean of Minutes. And I think, I agree 100%.
And again, everything that Nina described maps like almost one-on-one with any refugee immigrant experience where you move to a new place and basically you're at the whims of the bureaucracy and the government and institutions of this new place and where they will allow you to live and work.
And no one tells you the rules either.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is my last point because we are almost out of time. But what did you think about the difference between how America handled the pandemic in this book versus how Singapore and Sri Lanka and Taiwan dealt with it?
I did love that juxtaposition. That part made me it made me chuckle, but also made me go, oh, because it. Like, again, these
kind of
pandemic
what
books
in real life.
Yeah, sci-fi authors, their job is to, is to predict what the future would be given the current situation. And it's really depressing how most of these pandemic stories, most stories about pandemics, is about the current government or institution's inability to handle one. Right. Singapore, the little anecdote about Singapore being able to survive the pandemic because it was able to A, close off its borders and B, maintain trade relations with, and because it closed its borders and secondly, because they were able to share their resources with their neighboring countries in order to maintain trade and a sustainable ecosystem. It made a lot of sense because in these times, if the world had cooperated with each other, COVID probably wouldn't have been as bad as it is right now. But because, I don't think it's going out on a limb to say that a lot of our problems currently in this country about COVID, vaccinations, and the spread of the Delta variant right now, a lot of it has to do with America's identity as a nation of free peoples, which some people take to mean don't tell me what to do.
Yeah. With a lot of Asian countries, the reason why COVID got there in the first place is because of tourism. And it's people who did not care about other people's safety and health. They decided that they needed to go on vacation, and they were patient zero for that country. And the thought of how a lot of other countries have dealt with COVID much better because, they were more prepared. They have a better infrastructure for healthcare, and they're not getting the vaccines because America is hoarding most of the resources. And it's just so indicative of how America functions as a country and how, we thought that the pandemic would be over by now, or at least with vaccination. We're okay, we have this percentage of people vaccinated. It should be safe enough to go out and, wear a mask occasionally, but not all the time. But now there's the Delta variant, and we are pretty much at the same point as where we were last year around this time, which is so frustrating because this would not have happened if people just wore their masks and gotten vaccinated.
Well, and now we're being asked to be careful for the sake of people who aren't being responsible, right?
I'm just so mad. I know someone who was vaccinated and they got the Delta variant, and it's so infuriating that they got COVID after they got vaccinated because someone who wasn't vaccinated spread COVID around. And it's just like, it makes, like, I should care about other people and be empathetic, but it is very, very hard when people do not give a shit about other people's, like, lives.
Yeah. I mean, we're lucky that COVID isn't whatever this virus was in a notion of minutes, right? Otherwise, we'd be totally screwed. Like, right now, we just, no, there's no time travel to save us.
My question to you, Marvin, is would you do the time travel option?
I mean, I feel like we all kind of time traveled, right? Because what is 2020? Does anyone even remember 2020?
2021 is almost gone.
Oh, shit, you're right. Ooh, I don't know. I feel like I would read the contract first.
I mean, I already said that I would probably not go through with it. Like, no way.
I feel like as someone who is at least currently insured, I would probably, like, I would think about it. Like, if I had no other choice, maybe. But I don't know. It's hard to say what you'll do until you're met with that decision, right?
It's true. It's true. One last point. I don't know if you, like, you can edit this, like,
this is like your third last point.
Yeah, you can edit, like, whatever. Like, when Polly goes back to Buffalo and she realizes that it's not the city that, you know, she left it, it just kind of reminded me of, like, how a lot of immigrants, including children of immigrants, they go back to their motherland and they're like, this is not like how it was when I left. And I've mentioned this in other episodes, but like whenever I go back to Seoul, it's like, it's just like, it's been 5 years and everything is like, all the roads have changed and there's like all these buildings that like did not exist before.
I mean, that's the thing with immigration, right? Like, when you leave a country, when you leave a place that you lived in or is you're connected to, that place stays the same in your mind until you go back. Whereas that's not the way the world works. Life goes on without you. And yeah, that totally is what her homecoming to Buffalo was like, because not only did she come back, and much like the refugee experience, not only did she come back to her town that's totally changed, she went back to her the same hometown, but a different country now.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Nicely done, Thea Lim.
Yeah, nicely done. I'm sorry for the people who read this and were just like, I wanted a good fun time, but sorry.
I mean, it was never going to be a good fun time. It is a pandemic dystopia book.
Yeah, we read a pandemic book during a pandemic.
I think, so, yeah. Really. I mean, I read some reviews of people accusing it of being a bait and switch, whereas like it was sold to them as a time travel book, but it was really about this refugee experience. But I thought it was a really good refugee experience book with the trappings of time travel. And like,
okay, here's the thing. I have never read or seen a time travel story that wasn't about something else.
That's true. I mean, sorry, Thea didn't go into the intricacies of time travel, but you know, again, that's proprietary knowledge of the Time Razor Corporation that Polly did not have access to as a laborer. So
I don't know if you've seen the movie Looper, but they kind of like do the same thing where they're just like, explain the mechanics of time travel to me, and they're like, time travel is fucked up, we're gonna just be sitting here complaining and debating for hours on how time travel works. No, we're not gonna do that. And it's like, yes,
you just need to know that it exists and it works.
Yeah, you just need to know that it exists and your audience has to just believe it for a moment. Yeah. So really,
all right, well, let us know what you thought about An Ocean of Minutes by Thea Lim by sounding off in our Goodreads forums, engaging with us on Twitter, and just, I don't know, messaging us wherever on Instagram.
And yeah, did you agree with us? Would you? are you a Polly Frank shipper? Would you do this time travel contract? Please let us know in the comments.
Yeah. And with that, that'll do it for our discussion of our July 2021 book club pick. Once again, Rhea, thanks for joining me in this time travel journey of this, you know, fictional United States.
Yeah. I love talking about how capitalism sucks with you, Marvin, every single time.
I mean, it's not our fault. That is the theme of like many of the books that we've read and a lot of fiction that's out there right now.
True. Although this book came out in 2018.
That's true. Yeah. All right. So on that note, what are we reading for the month of August?
We are reading Randy Ribbe's Patron Saints of Nothing. So it is a young adult contemporary novel about a Filipino-American teen who flies to the Philippines to discover the truth about his cousin's murder. And the cousin's murder is apparently related to President Duterte's war on drugs. So also a fun time novel.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to discussing that with you at the end of the month. But with that, that brings us to the end of this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you once again for joining us for another great month. We are coming up on our fifth anniversary.
Yeah, fifth anniversary. Wow. We should probably do something. Yeah.
Let's spend August brainstorming of something to do.
Yeah, probably. Maybe we should actually meet in person. Oh. Like, I've seen you like once, and that was like for like maybe 2 minutes.
That's true. I think I was dropping off some food for you.
Yeah, you were dropping off something.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for joining us on Books and Boba, and we'll see you next time.
All right. Bye.
Bye, everyone. Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Ri Ryu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Brian, did you go to Saturday school as a kid?
I sure did. Did you?
Totally.
Well, at our podcast, Saturday School, we don't teach a language, but we pass along the culture that we do know.
And that's Asian American pop culture.
Ada is a journalist, and I'm a professor and film festival programmer.
We've watched a lot of great Asian American movies, and we want you to watch them too. Come listen to us as we look back at the pioneering films that have led us to today.